Welcome back to Good Morning Gateway, with me, Hugo Jackson. You're listening to 88.1 The Arch, and boy is it a pleasure to have you here on this foggy Tuesday morning. As I'm looking out of my window here, you can see the fog roll in. From the Mississippi, it's quite a beautiful sight to see. Here I have my trusty cup of joe, and I've unearthed something that I think will be a great help in telling my story. It's my journal. Now, I've had a lot of journals, and I've gone through a lot of paper, but in the end, I think that it will benefit this quality of the show, because I was able to dig through my trash closet, yes, we all have one, and I was able to find the corresponding journal for this show's time period. That way, instead of getting a faded recollection of events from someone who has all but changed, you will get a more present look at my life. As always, I much appreciate some feedback. So if you have anything to say about the show, if you want me to run it any differently, or you want me to talk about a topic, always make sure to either call in or contact the studio. I'll get your message, and I'll respond. Okay, well, there's another thing. It seems that my first show had some listeners after all, and I was able to secure a small sponsorship from Harry's Wasteland Gear Military Surplus down on the corner of Market in Miami. So, at some point today, expect me to give my little spiel. Okay, so, where were we? Last we ended off, I had just gotten my first job in the media business as a printer of the publication, The Daily Psalm. I had a larger goal of becoming chosen by the Mormon priest to gain citizenship, because I wanted to get within those great big Salt Lake City walls. I was starting to create a life for myself in Crimson Canyon, and I was going to market myself to the priests to try to see that I was citizen worthy. I ended the show about to start my first day on the job, so I guess I'll pick up from there. I walked up to the large rectangle building and walked around the side, realizing there was an entire front to the structure. A large, somewhat crude sign was drilled into the top of the building, displaying proudly the Daily Psalm, with the M at the end dripping an orange rust onto the walkway entrance. I walked through the front double doors, dodging the amber drip, and entered a small lobby with a cave-like appearance, the books and binders of content, pictures and files cascading around the room like stalagmites. This place was dark and dank. It almost seemed like not a building at all. Their lobby was empty, except for a serious-looking burly man sitting at the front desk, practically buried under all of his paperwork. I almost laughed. It seemed every Mormon man was larger than me, and stronger. He had an intense stare, a bushy brow. He looked at me and motioned me to come forward, so I did, but cautiously. You know, I took a few steps here and there, made them small. He explained that his name was Jeremy, and that I must be Hugo, the new printer, to which I replied that I was. With an affirmative grunt, he motioned for me to follow him. We walked around the headquarters through these small offices, again piled with papers, until we happened upon these two large metal basement doors that seemed to be humming with a sort of composed fury. With an exhale of the nostrils, Jeremy opened the doors, and we were greeted by a whoosh of hot air and that same humming in my chest. We descended the stairs about a level, and I saw these two large machines on either side of me. About the size of a Mississippi houseboat on either side, 8 feet tall probably, thrice that wide, Jeremy led me down the stuffy corridor to the end part of the machine, next to this long conveyor belt that was pumping out all these printed pages, and he began to yell in my ear, explaining my job to me. It was really stuffy. There were all these guys, only guys, down there. And this is what I wrote in my journal about it. Jeremy says I'm to box up the printed newspapers and take them upstairs to be shipped. The boxes are huge. I tried lifting up one of them and I couldn't even move it, and that was only half full. There's something about the prospect of working with Jeremy. His dark brow hides these intense blue eyes, like some sort of pure energy, calculating, judging. He walks every movement like he decides on every step, his joints and ligaments awaiting permission from those ocean eyes. Jeremy says I have to read the first books of the Bible by the end of this week, but I don't know how I'm going to accomplish that. There are so many words that I don't understand. So many names. Yahweh, Moses, Paul. Who are all these people? Even though I had my own anxieties about the job, I tried my hardest, and later that week, eventually confessed my inadequacies to Jeremy after my shift. I thought he would shake his head and soundlessly cross me off from some sort of list, but instead, his face softened and he offered to have me over for dinner to discuss questions that I may have had about the word of Moroni. I was incredibly surprised, and I eagerly accepted his invitation, and arrived at his house with a copy of the Bible and a gift, a spire necklace I had bought from a vendor on the way to Jeremy's house. He lived up in the mountain, and it took about half an hour of laborious weaving up through the chair to actually get there. It was almost late, but I arrived, wheezing and all. He invited me in and introduced me to his wife, Ada. I presented my gift to her, and she lit up, her smile sending out a feeling of radiance. She was quite pretty, and I hadn't noticed that initially. In contrast to Jeremy, her eyes were a light green, cozy little discs with an intensity to them that matched Jeremy's. While we were eating, Ada asked me about my story, and I indulged her. It was a nice dinner, and afterwards, Jeremy and I retired to the parlor to discuss questions I had about the faith. We ended up talking for more than 3 hours, much past his bedtime of 10 p.m., and agreed that we would meet in the future to discuss further. I got home and immediately started to journal, writing down as much as I could about the evening and conversation before it left my mind. While many of you in the Gateway may know of the state of Deseret, and may have Mormon friends who have told you a bit of Mormon history here and there, I think it is important to know the roots of a nation. After all, anything can't grow apart from its foundations. To know the context of something, the history of something, is to know the plane in which that thing operates. For the Mormon people, it is this narrative of the earnest hero, of the afflicted angel. I formulated this little hypothesis after my discussion with Jeremy, and my experiences with Mormon friends and foes, and here are my journal notes from that night. There's so much to learn. There's just so much I don't know. Jeremy spoke of the history of Deseret. It actually existed in the Old World, too. In the mid-1800s, Deseret was initially founded for a couple of years under the present Brigham Young, but was forced to bide its time under the pressure of the United States. Someone named Zachary Taylor was the president of the United States at the time, and he sent his lawmen and military into the rightful territory of Deseret to annex it as part of the great American empire. The Mormons, a peaceful people, decided to integrate, but holding the dream of Deseret ever in their hearts. While they carried on and called themselves citizens of the United States, their true goal was always in the back of their minds and center in their hearts. After the eruption and the bombs, they had their chance to fulfill their destiny. They came out of their basement bunkers and pooled their resources. Still, it wasn't easy to survive. Their world was coated in ash, waist deep. Their babies would choke on the dusty air. Their food would begin to quickly run out. Where most communities would begin to devolve into anarchy and chaos, the Mormon community became steadfast, with a couple exceptions. After the discovery of the Bible of Moroni, their next chapter would truly begin. By rallying their forces and women and children, they managed to make it to their Zion, or as it was called in the Old World, Carson City. Through all this, the narrative of destiny was ever present. This is not the destiny in the sense of, I will wait for it to happen to me, as God has already ordained it to be so. This was more of a promise that every Mormon had made to spread the word of Moroni and to bring their community to true prosperity. It was something that was non-negotiable, something whose priority transcended even that of family. It was with this fervor that the fledgling Deseret asserted itself to a new America, first with NORAD, and secondly with the Mormon-Sino War. This is why Jeremy must be so intense, why every Mormon I've met seems to have this air of power behind them. Those who identify with the Church act as a unit, almost a super organism, because of this need to persist through hardship towards that greatest light. Zion in every seed and every smile in the state of Deseret. I remember never actually getting to sleep that night, simply riding through the night, mind awash with all these new ideas. I had never had conversations of such a magnitude and depth before in my life, and it was something that I knew that I was missing. Almost like a color that you don't know exists until you see it, or a taste you haven't tasted until you taste it. Jeremy was an interesting conversation partner. He had this quiet intensity about him during conversation. His voice would climb to a slightly higher register, and he would really chew on what you said, sometimes waiting an entire minute, 60, 70 seconds, before you'd even respond. Contrary to my life in the Gateway, where everyone's always talking and you can't even get a word in edgewise a lot of the time, sometimes we would sit there for a little while, just pondering. It was definitely a new mode of communicating for me. He would recline back in his seat with this subtle smirk, turning over your words in his mind. And honestly, it felt really gratifying to speak to him. It felt like he was really listening to what you were saying, instead of just waiting for you to stop so he could start talking. And so that was the norm for a while. Working during the day, staying at the inn, and discussing with Jeremy, either after work or over dinner here and there. I got to learn a lot about the Bible. I got to learn a lot about the Church of the Latter-day Saints and Mormon culture, but I'm sure I won't bore you all of you with my thoughts on this theological concept or that. You get enough Mormons coming in from the West trying to convert you, so I'm not going to change my show into that. I also got to make some friends. There's a guy, Eddie, who was a couple rooms over, and we'd explore the canyon together. Omar was another guy I met while eating out, and he'd made my food. He worked in a restaurant. Sometimes we'd go out to bargain to make some extra dollars on the side. We'd sort of root through, I guess, the trash, if you want to say it bluntly, but we found some good stuff in there, honestly. It was pretty fun, and I needed to get that urge out. I became a common face around the printing room. I became one of the guys, right? It was nice to feel part of a group, especially since I'd spent so long primarily alone, even when I grew up in the Gateway, honestly. Time began to pass more quickly than before. I guess it seems to do that when you begin to automate your day, when you just get into the rhythm and you let muscle memory take over. The smell of hot dirt and ash was replaced by a colder dampness as the autumn began to approach. I was eventually promoted to delivering the paper instead of printing it, which had me go around with these two horses pulling a large wagon filled to the brim with the daily edition. While I was initially disappointed because I wouldn't be able to work with the printer group, I realized that it was a great way to explore more of the canyon. I met many people, so many I can hardly remember any of their names, but I never forget a face. Let's see. Oh, there was this old Chinese woman. She would always invite me in for Sierra and tea, but I'd always refuse because I was always on the clock. One day, I was tired of refusing, and I arrived at her shop after my shift, and we finally had tea together. She never said anything to me the entire time, just looked straight ahead, pausing every once in a while to refill my cup. Very strange. I even said some things, but it's like I was a wall. It was really good tea, though, so all in all, a pretty good experience. There was also, there was this one girl, about my age at the time. She worked the logistics for this general store. She might have been the owner's daughter. I dropped off my newspapers to her every day in the morning. To be honest, she was pretty cute. She had these two little dimples, and her nose would scrunch up when she was stern, which she always was when I would arrive. She'd always be eyeing down her workers, or just staring down people on the street. I would give her the papers, and before I left, she'd always splash me this nice little smile just for a second. Yeah. I wonder what she's up to now. Anyway. Anyway, I had a lot of experiences like that. That's the point I'm trying to make here. The little stories, little satisfying interactions, little things that I'd put on my belt, slip in my pocket, and walk around in the day, making my smile just a little bit brighter. The dampness of the crimson leaves hardened up as snow began to fall. I had to buy a coat, slowly starting to build up a collection of little knickknacks, pieces of clothing, letters from people, of course, leftover trash. Honestly, my room was beginning to get pretty messy. The routine was strangely comforting, partly because I felt like I was moving in a positive direction, slowly building those skills that I would use for the rest of my life. With Jeremy, I would begin to hone my mind. Each thought that I would share would be exposed to its foundation, its core concept. Slowly, as the seasons changed and the comfort of the canyons began to blanket down on my heart with the familiar coziness, I began to discover Jeremy's core concept. That thing that would keep him up at night. You know, we all have one, or two, or three, or hopefully not more than three. It would slowly creep into our conversations, talk about childbirth, babies, fatherhood. I mean, we didn't talk about these things all the time, but when it was brought up, the whole rest of the conversation was different. His whole mood and demeanor would change. He would take this dark tint to his face, like the sun suddenly obstructed by clouds. And I could tell that something was up. While he was young, he was past the stage of early adulthood, past the stage that most Mormons have their first children. But as far as I could tell, he and Ada had no kids, and they weren't expecting. After work one day, he seemed especially moody, looking straight at those double doors, as if expecting something to pop right out of them. I finally asked him about kids of his own, and when he was planning to have them. He looked down in shame and shook his head. "You've been waiting to ask me about him, I can tell," he replied. He gave a small smirk, as if to hide some deep pang. I nodded, and he continued. "Well, Ada can't have children, I'm afraid. We try, or at least we used to. Yeah, it's not gonna happen." I put my hand on his shoulder. I asked, "What are you gonna do? Are you going to take a second wife?" "That's what my father wants. That's what everyone would do in my situation. But I just can't do that to Ada. I just can't." We talked about it for a while. He described it like being trapped in a hole 20 feet deep, looking at the sky, the bright, light, shining sky of fatherhood. There was a ladder to his right and a rope to his left, and he moved from one side to the other, feeling out their respective materials, the give and strength of the wood, the tightness of the string, weighing these options. But mostly he would just pace in his hole, in this small circle staring at the sun, absolutely paralyzed. He talked about Ada being okay with his taking a second wife, but something inside him prohibited him from going through with it. All of these self-imposed barriers. If I know Jeremy, and I think I know Jeremy, it's that he wants to make the best decision. And that's an inherently great instinct. That's a great instinct to have. But sometimes when you want to make the best decision, you find yourself so ambivalent, torn apart by all these forces that you can barely comprehend. Your own nebulous want not to take on a second wife. You have your religion, your God, you have your interpretation of your religion, you have your mom, your dad, your wife as well. And there are all these things to take into consideration. But when your choice affects other people, as it does affect Ada, most of all, you simply don't have the luxury to wait and ponder all of your life. Sometimes you need to act. And you need to be content with the fact that your decision's not going to be perfect. He hadn't made a choice yet. I told him that waiting was a choice in and of itself, and he told me that he knew that. But he said that it would be worth it to make the correct choice in the end, to push through that barrier whenever it would come. While Jeremy was a kind-hearted, principled, loyal person, I just don't think that he had the gusto to push against that quicksand of ambivalence that we can all find ourselves in. Sometimes it's better to just jump in the river instead of going in little by little. That want for the best way forward became a tyrant. His need for a perfect answer undermined his finding of a good one. His love of a world of principle blinded him from the world of the practical. I really hope he chose, and I hope he's okay. Even though I just said all this stuff about how ambivalent he is, I know he'd make a fantastic dad. Are you planning on adventuring like I did? Prospecting, or just planning on a hike along the banks of the Mississippi? You're going to need high-quality refurbished gear to ensure both your safety and to make sure that others know you aren't to be messed with. This gear can only be found at Harry's Wasteland Gear Military Supply Store. The name might sound like a mouthful, but you won't be spending a walletful. That's because Harry does all of the refurbishment himself. Even in his 60s, he's a refurbishing machine, with over 10,000 items refurbished in his lifetime. Because he can refurbish so well and so quickly, Harry is able to sell his items for a fraction above their material value. Getting quality ingredients from Eastern prospectors, Russian ex-military, and even the United States, Harry is able to offer the lowest prices with the best old-world quality. Make sure to go down to the corner of Market and Miami and tell him I sent you there. By this point, I had lived 3 seasons in Crimson Canyon. The frost had begun to melt, the rivers flowing diamond blue with their characteristic milkiness. White gave way again to crimson, and brown gave way to green yet again. Wanting to stay ever the minimalist, I sold my coat and exchanged it for an old-world windbreaker. Those synthetic materials sure do last, and I want it in. My boots had worn through, so I had them fixed, the mosaic of old and new leather breaking through the dust and dirt. I wore pretty much only flannels, or the two that I could get my hands on. The first one I named Jetta, and Jetta was a blue and green flannel with intersecting white. She would whisper encouragement in my ear, tensing and flexing to protect me when I was roaming the ridge of the canyon, pushing me ever further. The second one was Kiki, and he was red and purple, and he was blue. Hugging my arms and carrying the little stomach I had begun to grow, like a mother carries her firstborn, he was a dear friend. I still had the same pair of jeans, though, ripped above the right knee, missing a back pocket with grease stains cascading down the back of my left leg. It felt like home. And honestly, home was becoming a bigger question as my stay in Crimson Canyon became longer and longer. Was my American journey going to end here? I still had the goal of becoming a Mormon citizen, but it quickly faded into the background. The priest didn't seem to be interested in me much at all. Why go into the strange city of Salt Lake when I already had a good thing going back in the canyon anyway? And I did enjoy my life thoroughly. Still, as I climbed further and further into my routine, there seemed to be this pressure building up from somewhere deep in my chest, like an itch in my throat. Sometimes I would be sitting there, studying or having a conversation with a friend, or eating dinner, and I'd suddenly want to leave, go outside. I'd feel this, I don't know how to explain, this explosion of passion, and I would run outside, licking the fresh mountain air. Sometimes, when I had climbed atop the canyon ridge, I would look out at the city, and then beyond, the familiar ashy gray haze in the background, those small impressions of people, or buildings, or animals. It's hard to tell from that distance. Perhaps they were scavengers out there, sort of like me. By the end of spring, I had processed what it was. I needed to leave, at some point anyway. All of my interactions took on a sort of deep, cerulean tint, like I was harboring this secret within me, like I was some sort of imposter, some sort of traitor. I carried this with me, under my tongue, hiding it like an ugly scar. When I'd talk to Jeremy or hang out with Eddie, it just didn't feel the same knowing that I'd already made up my mind that I was going to leave them. At the same time, I began to hang more around the restaurants and marketplaces in the area of town where most traveling through would be. I'd leave work without a goodbye to Jeremy or sneak into my room late at night in order to avoid Eddie. In retrospect, I guess I was already detaching, already preparing myself to leave. I guess it's sort of a good strategy then. One night, as I was bartering with a couple of strangers who were coming through, I noticed a small group of three filter in from the southern trail. They seemed to be simultaneously ready for anything, that glint in their eye, that spark, but also not prepared at all. The seeming leader of the group was this tall Chinese girl, about my age. In fact, they all seemed to be about my age. Maybe that's what drew me to them at first. The fact that they were like me, or at least of the same energy. Usually, I had no qualms about walking up and talking to people, but for some reason, I felt very sheepish to talk to them. I quickly ended negotiations with the other two strangers and slunk away to the alleyway to spy on them. The girl seemed to be searching for something, while the other two were squatting down next to her, with their heads down, keeping themselves together by sheer force of will. Slowly, I tiptoed from my dark alleyway towards the shop. Slowly, I came closer, until I realized I was right behind the girl. But I also realized that I didn't know what to do or say. I was completely enraptured by the moment. Just then, she turned around, startled, and looked at me straight in the eyes. She had these almond eyes, black as obsidian on ash, lashes that curved off the side of her lids like blade into night. I was caught. I sputtered out, "I saw you needed help. I am a denizen of this fine city and would love to help you guys out. What do you need?" She paused and regarded me with some look I took as skepticism, which was very well earned. The other members of the group raised their heads to peer at me. It was a boy and another girl. The tall girl mumbled slightly, so I could barely hear, and she crossed her arms in front of her, as if to guard her from my response. "We are looking for a place to stay the night." My eyes lit up. "Yes, I can help you guys out, of course. I've actually been staying in this inn on the outskirts, the Dusty Dragon it's called. The owner owes me a few favors, so I'll probably be able to give all of you a discount." The girl's eyebrow raised in that way that indicates definite skepticism. She wasn't buying it at all. But I didn't even know what I was selling, or why I'd even offered that discount in the first place. I'd have to use a favor, maybe two. That's a lot of favors for some random grifters. Still, there was something within me, something pushing me further. Even to this day, I don't know what it is. The group convened, whispering amongst themselves, giving me the odd look here and there. I shifted my weight onto either leg, feeling nervous again. Finally, the girl came to me and mumbled, "Okay, lead us there, please." I felt the breath taken out of me as I navigated through the stalls, the spires, the shifting of bills, the spittle of merchants chanting out their deals like the gibberish tongue of some sinister cult. We ducked under a clothesline to the front entrance of the Dusty Dragon. I opened the door and filed them in. I told them to wait by the side, to try to look pretty and presentable, while I talked to Mary the innkeep. I talked with her, who, after hearing my proposition, looked somewhat visibly upset. Unfortunately, I already knew why. Mary, being a devout Mormon and a righteous innkeeper, of course, did not want to, quote-unquote, sully her establishment with the ugly sounds of the Chinese language, as she called it. Still, I felt this driving desire to help these people out. In mid-conversation, Mary seemed to get angrier and yelled to the corner where they were standing. "Why don't you just go over to Little San Francisco? I'm sure they'll take you there." The girl gave a subtle shake of her head. She mumbled, "We can't go there. I'm sorry." Mary turned to me. I couldn't understand her through her thick accent. What did she say? At this point, my patience was wearing thin, and I was beginning to become angry too, because it was ridiculous, but I kept it in. I pushed it down. There was something I needed to get done. I took Mary aside. "Look, these are good friends of mine, and I would really appreciate if you let them stay. I'll even pay you a premium on top of what they pay. Consider this a favor. Please?" Mary leaned back, playing with my proposition in her mind, feeling its weight. "Fine, but I don't want them hanging out in the lobby. I can't have my friends knowing that they are guests of mine. And only for one night, got it? Then they're gone." "Okay," I say. "Thank you." I sure as hell didn't feel like thanking her, but I wasn't going to try my luck. I walked back to the group and gave them the lowdown. The guy in the group put his hand on my shoulder and thanked me. He smiled as his eyes betrayed him, twitching with the shutdown of exhaustion. I showed them to their rooms, gave them my room number, and told them to find me after they'd rested, perhaps in the morning. The girl with obsidian eyes nodded humbly, and I left them to their devices. I snuck back into my room, making sure not to disturb Eddie. What was going on? My body was pins and needles, an infinite night sky morphing into static, a rock weighing down on my stomach. You know, I needed to go to the bathroom. I relieved myself, but only felt a tad better. If better meant not as extreme? I don't know. It was difficult to pin down. On the one hand, my hands were shaking, which seemed bad, but I had this weird grin on my face. I looked at myself in the mirror like some sort of clown. Anyway, I calmed down a bit and tried to write in my journal, and that failed, and I tried to read, but gave up a couple of paragraphs in. I ended up tossing and turning in my bed, trying to deal with my chattering monkey mind, trying to go to bed later in that night when a small knock sounded from my door. My mind went silent. I tiptoed up and slowly opened it, my eyes wide as fireworks. Obsidian Girl was crouched at my door with her hand outstretched and an upward fist resting on the door frame. She whispered, "I hope I didn't wake you. Would you like to talk with us?" I nodded eagerly. I followed them. My mind yet again swarmed. I swear, man, I was crazy. I was out of my mind. Maybe it was the fact that I hadn't been around kids of my age in a while. Jeremy was in his 30s and Eddie was in his mid-20s. I just had this feeling like these Chinese kids were more my age. They looked younger. Maybe someone who could really relate to me. Or maybe it was because I said I'd wanted a way out of the canyon for a while now, and these travelers seemed like they could use another pair of hands. Or maybe it was because I felt like I was in charge with them, people I could pass the baton of help towards, instead of constantly feeding on everyone else's hospitality like some sort of leech. Or maybe it was none of these reasons, or maybe it was all of them. Anyways. I was feeling crazy. I followed her into their room to see the other boy and girl looking slightly better. Without even giving them a chance to introduce themselves, from somewhere in my maniac brain, I sputtered out, "Where are you guys going?" There was a silence coming over the room like a wind blowing out a boat of candles. Obsidian Eyes sat herself nimbly across from me and looked into mine, furrowing her brow and letting a determined smirk sink slowly into her dirty face. She looked straight into my eyes and said it. "The caldera." My eyes widened. "The crater?" Her head tilted slightly down, affirming my question. I couldn't help but let out a little excited whimper. "Yellowstone." And that is a great place to stop for today. Thank you so much for listening to Good Morning Gateway. Hopefully your coffee's been finished by now and You're pouring yourself another glass. I'm looking at my cup here, and yeah, I have one more cup of Joe to go for this morning. I have a great show planned for next week, so hopefully you can tune in then. And as always, have a blessed day.